Hi, I'm Maya Garantz.
And I'm Rebecca Cohen.
And this is The Sauce, the culture and politics podcast where we drink cocktails and ruin the stuff you love.
Today, we are going to be talking about young adult literature in the context of this hashtag never again movement.
But also, I think we are also going to have to include the less talked about in the news, but just as active Black Lives Matter movement.
And we have something special, which we've never really done before, which is a couple of interviews with experts in the field who can maybe shed some light and answer some questions for us.
So we're going to be talking with Sarah Mesley, who's a writer and an editor and is going to provide us the like academic laser-like sort of theory. I mean, this is what we're really going to do. We have theories. And then we're going to go to these experts to see if they agree with our theories. So I feel like Sarah Mesley is an academic. She is a literateur. She's like a writer about literature. She's a professor. She's an editor. And I feel like she'll have the sort of laser down theory read on it. And we might also talk to some young people about whom we are theorizing.
Yes.
And see if they have anything to say about our theories about them.
We first have to talk about what we're drinking. So, Maya, what are you drinking?
I'm drinking a sort of tequila cranberry situation, and it's actually quite nice.
Excellent. I feel like that should be the name of the cocktail you invented, the tequila yes. cranberry situation.
And you?
I am having wine out of a box, but I just received a lovely surprise gift from my husband who came home with a bottle of soju, the Ooh, Korean nice. Grain alcohol. Yeah, so as soon as I finish my wine, I'm going to switch to that because you know what they say, wine before liquor, get drunk quicker. That's how it goes, right?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay, so I want to talk about young adult literature as it relates to the activism we're seeing from teens right now in this moment. A few days ago, maybe a few weeks ago, I definitely saw some tweets that were suggesting the idea, semi-jokingly, that this is a generation, these young teens are a generation that were fed on the Hunger Games and the Divergent series and the Maze Runner series. These are teens that grew up reading dystopic fiction about teens bringing down, you know, the evil regimes, the totalitarian regimes that yes. were oppressing them, and how this must have primed them to be ready for this moment and turn them into activists.
Mm.
Well, I think there's truth to that. I definitely think that there's something to that. And we could definitely do a deep dive, I think, into the Hunger Games, which is interesting because it's, I think, more subversive than it gets read as. It's a book that's on the surface, very obviously, it's about the working classes being exploited by this pampered elite who take all the fruits of their labor and keep them in poverty and pit them against each other and send their young people to fight and die while they live in the lap of luxury and so forth. It's like pretty obvious. But then ultimately, it doesn't actually advocate for Katniss's involvement in bringing that system down. In the end, the revolutionary regime turns out to be, if not just as bad as the regime they brought down, still a villain, because they still subscribe to some of the same structures. You know, it's like replacing right. one person with the other, but keeping certain structures in place.
Right.
And Katniss, in the end, has to remove herself from that. And it's this very anti-war message because the whole series is supposed to be about, it all starts from her saving Prim, her sister. And then ultimately that fails.
Right. But here's my question about it. Isn't the whole thing about how like this is this game show.
Yeah.
And then we get invested in watching the game show. Like, mm-hmm. I feel like, isn't that the problem? Like, I definitely feel at least that that's such a problem with the movies.
Oh, yeah.
Is that it's movies are essentially the Hunger Games. Like, they're not, like, better than, they're not challenging that. They're not, like, doing anything else.
Yeah. It's a major flaw in the books that I think is even worse in the movies, but it's absolutely there in the books. And yeah, you have a movie where you are literally cheering on the murder of children.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
It's a problem. Yes. It's a problem. Right. Which is why I think it wasn't very successful in getting across the messages I think it was trying to. But still, the larger point being that I definitely think there has been this wave of young adult literature that centers around teens overthrowing an oppressive regime, an evil regime, teens taking power back in a very explicitly political way.
Right.
But here's the thing. I think that there's a book series way more powerful than any of those dystopia YA novels that has really shaped the attitudes of this generation.
Okay.
And it's the Harry Potter series.
I mean, it's sort of like, how can that be surprising when it's only the biggest fucking series of all time?
Right,
you know what I mean?
Right,
where it's
right,
like, I'm expecting you to say something else. And then it's like,
no,
Harry Potter. No, yeah, because it completely shaped the culture.
It did completely shape the culture. To put a point on what you were just saying about how big it is, I was curious about which YA novels have been the most popular over time. And I found a list of the top, the best-selling YA novels of all time.
Okay.
And it turns out that Harry Potter books are 7 of like the top 10 best-selling of all time.
Wow.
And interestingly, I thought this was interesting, 9 of the top 12 are from the last 20 years. So that's basically, it's the Harry Potter books.
Wow.
Hunger Games.
Wow.
And The Fault in Our Stars.
Huh.
Which is like a whole other thing.
We're going to have to
kind of
put
interesting.
That to the side.
Definitely put a pin in that because that's interesting. The point here is that Harry Potter dominates the top of that list. I think it's fair to say that we definitely have a generation that we could kind of call the Harry Potter generation.
Yes.
We have kids who've grown up reading and loving Harry Potter and talking about Harry Potter. They've never known a world without Harry Potter.
That's right.
And I think that has had a powerful influence on their perception of themselves as political actors.
All right. Well, so this is our theory. So let's like get into a few specific things that we see as affecting that. Because I also think it's interesting that the people reading these novels who we're thinking about right now, they came into consciousness during Bush 2.
Yes.
But then they were there to really witness and be affected by and be shaped by Obama. Like, that was huge. And then they had that kind of turned around by Trump. So if we're going to like paint this picture, I think we have to like create the structure of that.
I was just texting with my niece, who is turning 18 in a couple of days, because I wanted to get a teenager's take on it. And, you know, she said that she read the Harry Potter books or started reading them when she was 10 or 11 years old. So it would have already been the Obama years by the time she was reading them. And that would probably be true for any teen these days. They grew up, became aware of the world during the Obama presidency. And now, like, think about what a crazy sea change that is.
Because that's also part of the books. The years that Voldemort was first supposed to be in power are the same years that Margaret Thatcher was in power.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. So that was actually something that was sort of part of what is going on.
Interesting.
There is this sense like everything's fine, right? The bad guy's gone. It's done. We have Obama. We're done. And then it's like, no, it's not done.
You brought up the idea of the one true savior, the trope or motif that's in a lot of fantasy fiction of the chosen one, which in this case is Harry. Very explicitly, there's a prophecy and everything, right? So the chosen one is this individual, almost always a white male,
yep,
who is going to save everyone.
Yeah.
And I made the argument that the one true savior aspect of Harry Potter is almost a red herring. It's almost there as window dressing to sort of give the narrative a familiar quality and to make it fit into the structures we're familiar with. But ultimately, when you talk to people about it, when you listen to fans talk about it and see how they engage with it, it's never about that. All of the ancillary products are about you going to Hogwarts, you getting sorted into a house, finding out what your Patronus is. It's not about you being Harry. It's all about this like team effort. It's all about all the staff and students coming together, working together. There's this cooperation and teamwork element to it that I feel like is very powerful.
I mean, you could say that about any one true savior narrative. I mean, I feel like for me, the sort of one true savior narrative that I feel like is so central is Star Wars. I mean, yeah, I feel like right. that's everything in terms of setting us on this course mm-hmm. where it's like every blockbuster movie, every mm-hmm. fucking, it's at this, I can't even watch previews anymore because right. it's like the world is going to end. Will this one true savior save it? Over and over again. It's so fucking tired. I can't even.
Right.
Does everybody think of themselves as Luke? Do people dress up as Luke? Like, no.
Just looking structurally at the narrative, looking at the way the story plays out, Luke is the one who makes the important things happen when all is said and done.
Yes.
His friends are helpful and they're there, but in Harry Potter, Harry is not the one who makes the important things happen. More often than not, it's Hermione. And sometimes it's right. Dumbledore and all the people around him who are working to make things happen. And you got like 7 books, the bulk of which is Harry being like, I don't really know why I'm the chosen one or what I'm going to do or what this really means. And it's only at the very, very end that it really comes to mean anything.
I mean, I feel like so much of it belabors, and there is that part where it's like, you might not have been the one true one, you know, one chosen one, if Voldemort had chosen the other guy to be the one, but he did choose you, so you are, and like, there's so much laboring over that.
Yes,
you know what I mean?
There is a lot, like, there's that's true.
A lot of laboring over like, you're the guy, and I feel like the other stuff is built up there so that other people can participate. But I feel like it's still very anchored on his sacrifice, on
that's
his,
that's very
like,
true. And like the scar, the scar and what that represents about his specialness and his fame.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, let's go back to the first one true savior narrative, which is Jesus. Yeah. I feel like what we're dealing with is that all of these are kind of like rewritings of like Jesus, like of the Christ story. It's a great story. Like, you know, like the one guy, he's like the guy, you know, and you can get all complex and be like, actually Judas is the real person who sacrificed because he sacrificed his soul to make the savior happen or whatever the Gnostics
That's
said. God bless
yeah.
the Gnostics. But I feel like at the end of the day, the other stuff is like participation, because it's almost all of it is from his point of view too.
That's true.
It's all, you know, his POV.
You're right. It is a pretty big element. It's inescapable. But I would still argue that the way that fans interact with it and the way it's appreciated is maybe not reflective of that. That people, what they treasure about the books is this idea of this magic school where you could go and you can become a wizard. You take these different classes, you meet these cool people, and you learn
it's
all
these
the
like
stuff.
World around it. It's all the world around
the world. I did ask my niece, my soon to be 18-year-old niece, you know, did you read them and did you like them? And she said, I loved them. And it was like all my friends and I talked about. This is all over text message, of course, because I'm talking to a teenager, so we were texting.
Of course. You know.
And so I said, what did you like about them? She said, I loved the whole idea that it was the kids who were using their powers for good and that they were learning new things about themselves and their powers in each book.
Mm.
I asked her which house she wants to be in because she couldn't remember what her Pottermore house was. And she said Gryffindor. So I asked why. And she said, they were always the good ones, the leaders.
Mm.
I don't know. I found that interesting. The association of this world with the opportunity to lead. There's this really important element of the story, which isn't Harry discovering what the prophecy means and what his destiny is. That's part of it. But there's this other part that's him organizing Dumbledore's army, getting a group of kids to meet together and plan their activism and get good at it, get good at right. what they're doing and right. find allies, adult allies, peer allies.
Well, and in terms of that, I think for me, what I always was the most interested in the Harry Potter books as a series is that the books grow up with him.
Yeah.
So as he gets older, the world gets more morally complex. And I feel like that's the great achievement of them as books. And there's a way in which the idea of a kid reading it, especially as they came out year by year, as their own worlds are getting more morally complex, I thought was fantastic.
That is a real credit to the books. And I'm glad you said that, because in a previous episode, before Maya's time on the show, our previous co-host Rosie and I did a whole show on Harry Potter. We basically tore it apart. We're like, here's all the problems with Harry Potter. So everyone go back and listen to that one. It's very funny and smart. But it is great to also look at what is wonderful about those books.
But also you have to deal with it, whether you like it or not. You can tear it apart, but it's had this undeniable impact on the culture.
Right, right.
So instead of just saying it's good or it's bad, it's more like, what is it? You know what I mean? Like, what
For
the
real,
fuck
though,
is it?
What is it? Like,
okay, so this is where I think we have to get back to,
okay,
do we think that this is having an impact on current youth political activism?
So I go back to my niece's answer via text message when I asked her what she liked about the books. Because there's a lot of different things she could have said, but she said, I love the whole idea that it was the kids who were using their powers for good and that they were learning new things about themselves and their powers in each book. So right. she's sort of hinting at what you were talking about the sort of growth across the books. She's not talking about the loss of innocence and so forth, but that's kind of part of it, is as you grow and get more powerful and learn more things, things get more complicated.
And with your increasing power comes increasing responsibility.
I heard that somewhere. But I think it's interesting that what's standing out for her, she didn't say the world building. She didn't say the magic conceits were fun. What she said right. was, the kids were using their powers for good and they were growing in their power and their self-knowledge. So if I think of that as being something that a kid between the ages of 10 and 13 is fantasizing about, right? Seeing right. themselves in right. that book. If that's the case, then in this case, the fantasy is of empowerment.
Yes.
But not, you know, you're the kid from the Twilight Zone movie that can make anything happen with his mind kind of empowerment.
Right.
Which was terrifying for people of our generation who may remember that film. But rather a growing and learning and using your powers for good kind of empowerment.
Right. And also this, maybe this idea that as you're gaining this power, there is a use for them. There's a very yes. like,
there's an application.
Critical application for this, which is saving the world. Like, this is very important that you have these skills.
Yeah.
Because they are necessary.
And that's what I'm getting at, is like, when you look at the climax and how it all plays out, it really isn't just about like Harry faces down Voldemort and this one-on-one confrontation. It's about Hogwarts as a fortress.
Yes.
Which, by the way, the teachers are armed at Hogwarts.
Yes, that's like,
they, yeah, and there are
extraordinary
security measures at that school.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, maybe that's another topic. But they're going to come to this big confrontation. They're going to have to use what they've learned. They're going to have to work together. And it's going to be, like you said, it's going to be a life or death, saving the world situation.
Everybody's going to have to be a part of it.
Yes.
Like, yeah, nobody can sit out.
You can't escape it. You can't. Yeah. Exactly. You can't sit out. You can try, but you're going to be affected one way or another, because if you don't, if you try to sit it out, somebody's going to win. And if it's Voldemort and the Death Eaters, you have to live with that just as much as, you know, whether if you fought.
That's right. That's right.
That's very political when it comes down to it.
One of the questions I have, though, is that we had a generation of kids who organized over Vietnam. So I don't think Harry Potter was necessary. I think my question is there something connecting the world of these books to the world of the present political moment?
There's something in the way that J.K. Rowling realizes the threat in her novels that is just, it feels very familiar.
Mm.
And it's not just the rise of evil. She's very careful about this in the books. That's the thing. It's not just that Voldemort comes back. He comes back slowly, like creeping fascism.
Yes.
He comes back slowly and people don't believe in it.
Yes.
And there's this whole population of Death Eaters who are living among us. They are your neighbors and your friends and your classmates and their parents, and you don't know who is one of them.
Right.
You have other people who may or may not actually be affiliated with the Death Eaters, but they're still helping them along by refusing to believe Harry's testimony, you know, that he saw.
Right.
Voldemort.
Kind of like the evangelicals, kind of like the evangelical community supporting Trump.
Kind of, yeah, among others. Yeah, the nature of the threat, she very carefully establishes it and realizes it in a way that, to me, felt so familiar during the Bush era, but it's only like 10 times more so now.
Right.
The gaslighting.
Yes.
Having people who are in positions of authority and power who should know better and maybe even do know better, but they're looking in your face and, you know, somebody's pissing in your face and they're telling you it's raining. And that frustration and the powerlessness you feel from that and the empowerment in coming together despite all of that right under Dolores Umbridge's nose.
Right.
It's so much more than just a good versus evil and the bad man is coming, you know, Sauron is gaining power. We've got to fight him. There's bureaucracy involved.
Right.
There's bad, there's bad press involved.
Right. So we're dealing, so we're learning how to negotiate the press, but we also learn the power of the press if you deploy it properly.
Yes.
Which Hermione does.
And the power of fame.
And the power of fame if you deploy it correctly.
Yes.
We're learning about how to organize and build our skill sets in secret.
Mm-hmm.
We're learning how to recognize who's flipped over to the dark side.
Yes. We're learning how to sort through the bullshit, you know?
Right.
How to not get gaslighted. And
right.
This is it. We're learning how to not let the conversation stand on their terms. Not let them define the parameters of the discourse.
All right. I think we have a theory. I think we're going to have to test this out.
Okay. Well, we'll ask the experts.
I think we're going to have to ask the experts. And I think part of that is talking to some more youngins.
Yeah.
As well.
We got to talk to some kids. I wonder, though, how self-aware kids would be about these influences, because the real power of influences like this is that
you don't see them.
Yeah, that they're changing the way you think in the back of your mind in ways you're not exactly examining. But then when push comes to shove and you find yourself in that situation where well, I don't know, let's say you and your classmates are being threatened in your school.
Right.
Right?
Right.
There is a threat, a life and death threat against your school. You and your peers and the faculty who support you can come together.
Right. It is. There's also this thing that I think is interesting, that I think is particularly radical in America, where the school is the fortress.
Yeah.
Like, the most important place is the school, especially in a country that is so anti-intellectual as ours is.
Right.
But it's also one of the things that a lot of people have been talking about, which I very much feel, is that a lot of the Parkland students have been made ready by this moment through a very good public school education.
Yes.
Through history teachers that had been talking to them already about the NRA as a lobbying organization, through debate teams, through the drama club, through all of these things where they were ready for this moment. And of course, good public schools are allowed to happen in places where people have money. Mm-hmm. So let's be clear about the sort of race and economic inequities that allow good schools to happen in one place and other schools to struggle. But also that makes me think about before Parkland, I think an incredibly youth-led movement is Black Lives Matter. That is also something where it's like the same generation of young people who are active, organized, on a team. Mm-hmm. Black Lives Matter was organized in this incredibly collective way by young people. Everybody sort of took on their piece of it. So many of communities worked on it. They communicated with each other via social media. And BLM was a hugely inspiring movement, but it did not get the play that Parkland is getting. And I think that's one of the things I want to stop and talk about is it that the Parkland teens are actually doing anything different, or is it how they are able to capture a sort of wider imagination and conversation in a way that Black Lives Matter was like? Black Lives Matter did so much, but for instance, I was talking to my niece who goes to a very nice school where they're being very well educated. They're doing a walkout tomorrow, or actually today. And I said, did your school have a walkout or any kind of activism around Black Lives Matter? And she was like, no. Well, yeah, because there aren't many Black students at her school. And so it doesn't directly affect them. And so they didn't protest it. And like, there's none of that fear of Black people that hounded the Black Lives Matter movement, which was an incredibly peaceful, brilliantly organized movement. Like, all of the things, all of the plaudits that are being given to the Parkland teens right now are equally as true of Black Lives Matter.
Right. And we can talk about the first and most obvious difference, right? Yeah. I mean, you're talking about a movement in Black Lives Matter that is organized by, driven by, populated by mostly African-American people, that is fighting for African-American people. So white people are going to fall somewhere on a spectrum where maybe they're like, but we're not racist, so everything's fine. Or maybe they're on the other end of the spectrum where they are offended and appalled and they hate Black Lives Matter for challenging them. And then there's everything in between, and it's complicated and difficult because you have a group of people literally asking another group of people to stop oppressing them. You know, it's Black people demanding a change of behavior from white people. And that's a huge oversimplification, obviously. And it's really about policing and law and order and a whole system that we have that's deeply, deeply flawed and harmful. But what a lot of people walk away from it with is it's Black people talking about Black stuff and may not be able to connect with it or see the need or feel the need for it, which is a shame. With this Never Again movement, you have these kids from Parkland who are largely white.
I think part of their preparation is a certain kind of entitlement.
Yes.
Which I feel like we all should feel that entitlement to speak our truth to power.
Yes.
And they have that entitlement. And I feel like that entitlement is being rewarded by a country that is feeling the resistance, that's ready to hear them, but it's just breaking my heart. And I think that another thing that makes Black Lives Matter complicated is that I think that white allies don't know how to be supportive. They like, yeah. I think that that's also complicated, but it's bullshit that it should be complicated at all. Like, why are these Parkland teens getting the sort of national respect that Black Lives Matter didn't? And then also, in terms of that, can we see that this generation being any better politically? When it reminds me of, I remember hearing somebody say, if you want to get young people pissed off, reinstitute the draft.
Right.
Like, as long as there's no draft, there isn't going to be that same level of anti-war activism. People respond when it directly affects them. And my niece was like, yeah, I mean, because we're students and we should be safe at school.
Like, yeah, yeah.
The message hits students, but then the non-Black students are not like standing up for people who are not them. How can we get people to sort of cross that boundary?
Well, that's a very big question. I mean,
oh yeah, I know we're not going to solve that right now.
But to the question that we are tackling, Black Lives Matter has the challenge of white people finding Black people demanding anything to be threatening. It doesn't matter.
Right.
It doesn't matter that they're saying, please value our lives. Don't kill us in the street. That's threatening to a lot of white people. But nice white teens saying, don't kill us in our classrooms feels less threatening.
And I feel like it's a problem that extends all the way, you know, down to the students themselves.
Of course.
So at the same time that I'm so excited for the walkout and feel like, oh, are these students learning some tools, some organizing tools, some tools of civic responsibility, that gap between how we're treating Parkland versus how we're treating Black Lives Matter really pains me.
Yeah.
It pains me.
A lot of it also, though, I think has to do with our current political moment where we are. You know, Black Lives Matter happened during the Obama presidency, and people felt very complacent. And when I say people, I mean progressive people who might be inclined to be excited about a political movement and who might be excited to support something like that. And fast forward to now, you know, we've talked about this, but you have hashtag resistance going on. You have
right.
the Women's March. You have a lot of models for what the resistance is and how it should look. You have a huge amount of energy. People are donating. People are participating in all these like special elections. They're getting out and canvassing. There's a really high level of participation and interest because of the outrageousness of what's going on. So the Never Again movement is able to just be of a piece with that. The Never Again movement right. is able to fit into that scenario and be part of the larger story of resistance in a way that maybe even the same teens in the same scenario a year and a half ago maybe wouldn't have.
It's true. And I think that in that way, if you're going to be really cynical about it, I feel like it's these privileged kids who are really benefiting from the labor of people of color.
Oh yeah.
Like,
yeah. I mean, it's the oldest story in the book, right?
Yeah. It's because I feel like there is a way in which Black Lives Matter and the sort of innovation that they did as a movement in terms mm-hmm. of organizing and in terms of their social media
yeah, using
presence,
social media. Mm-hmm.
Like there was a lot of innovation and organizing happening. And absolutely, the Parkland kids right now really benefit from that. And I think
I agree.
The resistance as a whole benefits from that.
Oh, yeah. It absolutely. The resistance as it exists now would not exist if it had not been for Black Lives Matter. And you don't get a lot of acknowledgement of that, which is a shame. And you don't see Black Lives Matter getting folded into resistance activities like you
That's
might
right.
hope. It's sort of last year's concern, which is right. tragic. I will say one more thing about the Parkland kids is that you said right off the top that Black Lives Matter was a very sort of plural movement with a lot of people behind it, very collectively organized. And while this is very true of the Never Again movement, there are also these outstanding figures, particularly some of the Parkland teens, whose faces and names are now known. Yes. And I think that that gives people something to latch on to. People don't like, at least Americans, don't love a leaderless movement. It's part of why the Occupy movement sort of fizzled. People don't know what to do with that. You know, they want MLK standing at the podium, spouting the moral righteousness that they can get behind. That's how Americans imagine activism.
Well, so then that actually brings us back to the one true one.
Oh, good point.
And the dependence on the one true one, even in a Harry Potter narrative that actually is successful because his survival depends on the group. And and his, like, everybody winning depends on everybody's participation. But then it's still anchored to the one true one. And I feel like that is... that then brings us back to like our Christ problem in American politics and in narrative. I mean, every narrative has a protagonist, but the sort of need for the protagonist hero, for the one true one, for the chosen one. Mm-hmm. I feel like it's very complicated in this moment, especially because the actual work, I mean, Connor Lamb just might have won this like Trump district last night, which is crazy.
I believe he did officially win.
The Democrats there, every registered Democrat in that district got a phone call reminding them of the vote. They walked every fucking street. Mm-hmm. Like, people whose names we will never know.
Yeah.
Did every block in that entire district to make last night happen. So where do we put that work in our storytelling?
That's and a then how great do we, question.
And then how do we commit to the justice of people when the issue does not strike us specifically?
So this is an interview I did with my UC Santa Barbara student, Essie Reeves, about the long-term impacts of Harry Potter.
We have a theory, and I want to test it out on you. Our theory is that young people right now, of which you are one, are trained for activism in a certain way because of dystopian YA literature. And that, like, Harry Potter in particular has such a massive impact on the cultural imagination that it's actually prepared you for this moment.
You know, I could actually see that, especially because when I was in, I mean, it was like late elementary school for me, middle school-ish, and then even in high school, like everyone was so obsessed with it. I remember knitting a Slytherin scarf for a friend of mine in high school, and we had matching ones. It was like... it was our lives for a little while.
Wait, is it your house Slytherin?
Well, okay, at the time, you also have to recognize that this was in high school when being emo was kind of a thing. So that was kind of our version of rebelling, was we were house Slytherin instead of Gryffindor. Because they were the goody two shoes, you know?
That's awesome. I love that. Okay, so you were into it. You're doing it, you're knitting scarves, you're doing all of this stuff, and?
And, yeah, and I think it definitely, it gives, even just being an 11-year-old watching the first one, I mean, these are just little kids running around using magic, fighting evil, and it gives children a certain sense of agency in situations. It kind of, like, I guess perpetuates the idea that, like, we have more power as kids than we think we did. Because they don't have parents around telling them, no, you're not going to go fight Voldemort. Or even when the professors were telling them that, they were like, we're going to go fight a troll anyway, 20 points for Gryffindor. And even when, I think more people were watching the movies at the time than they were the books. And definitely the nature of the movies, as they got darker and angstier, seemed more dystopian in nature. It was much more of a serious rebellion rather than a wands and magic and whimsy rebellion. And I think now, since the climate is kind of tending towards this like dystopian nature, that's probably manifesting itself in kids even subconsciously.
Did you find, so you found these books empowering in that way? Do you even remember what those feelings were?
I did in a way. I don't know that it was so obvious to me. Like it was such like a strong, like, well, Hermione did it, so I should do it. Although Hermione was a great character. I think it was more along the lines of, you know, like when you're watching a movie and then you leave and you kind of, you take on the mood of that movie and you feel like empowered, but you, like, you're not living the movie, so you don't really blame the movie for it. It was kind of that. It was like an afterglow from the movies or from the books. And from like talking to people about them and how the next one was coming out. And it definitely, I think it resonated in a subconscious sort of way. But I remember when The Hunger Games came out also. And those definitely, I mean, they put children in an arena, so that was much more cutthroat. But it was, you know, one of the first times where children's books didn't cater to kind of censoring themselves and creating this, like, world that kids, you know, want to live in, like, the dream world. It was, oh, like, now we're getting down and dirty, and then it does make you feel a little more mature than I guess previous generations might have. I guess in that sense, it did resonate with me. Like it definitely made me feel like I had more agency and was more capable than I feel like peers might have thought.
So one thing I see in a lot of movies now, which I feel like we could do a whole episode on, is the sort of like the one true one. The one person who's going to be the one to save the whole world, that one guy. And I feel like to me, that's what gets in the way of this theory. Because I feel like all of these books are like the one true guy. It's the one guy.
Yeah. Yeah, like the chosen one and Harry. And I think something they really drove home with that, though, you know, that whole like underlying theme of friendship throughout the movie, no matter how hokey it was. It was definitely more prevalent in the books, I think, because Harry had to depend on Ron and Hermione much more than in the movies. They definitely made him seem like this is the chosen one, this is the one. But in both, he needed his friends to help, you know, win the final battle. In each scenario at the end of each story, it was the three of them doing something together to fight. But I think that isn't as prevalent in the stories as the chosen one, the one. And I think there might be a lot of kids out there trying to convince themselves that they are the one. They are the special one because this is the only consciousness you experience. This is the only life you have. And they lose that idea of like connectivity. And I think that's something that the kids that are leading March for Our Lives right now have really tapped into. They've really understood that to keep the conversation going, you've got to create a community that's going to push it forward because one person isn't going to be able to get 100 people talking. 100 people are going to be able to get another 100 people talking and so on and so forth. And that's what's going to keep the ball rolling. Because you need people to join. You need people to just fight. The same with the Dakota Access Pipeline last year. That never would have worked if it was just, you know, 100 people, but it was thousands. And there is no one in those situations to make the problem go away. It's people swinging to the other side.
What's interesting about the books is that in Voldemort's first reign, you know, that happens before the books start, J.K. Rowling set those years during the years that Margaret Thatcher was in power. That was like how she like historically set it up. And I think that there is something interesting about this moment in that you guys had for your sort of dominant coming into adulthood, Obama was president, and there can be this feeling like it's done. We're done. He's dead. Like the evil is gone. And then Trump comes back and it really is like Voldemort's return.
Yeah, I think that's what made it so shocking too, was that, you know, we got rid of Bush. And we were like, woo, like victory, we're moving forward. And then we moved forward for two terms. And then it was just kind of out of nowhere. Just absolutely flabbergasting. And I think with the setting of her books also, it kind of reminds me of like Dadaism as an art movement, that you need this, you need something to rebel against. You need something to, you know, strike the match and start the change. And with Voldemort, it was Voldemort's rise to power, the violence that came with it, and people fought against it, and he was gone for a while. And then the violence started again, and then Harry and his friends fought against it, and now it's gone. And I don't think that there should always be something to fight against or fight for, but we're constantly changing. And I was listening to this interview with Gloria Steinem yesterday, actually, talking about how people of this generation right now, like the kids fighting, a lot of people will say they're not grateful for the changes that have happened in the past because they don't know how bad it used to be, but that change is going to constantly be coming. And while the current political state isn't fantastic, it is sparking change that needed to happen that probably wouldn't have happened if things had stayed peachy and we had another Obama.
So we thought that maybe, as opposed to just depending on our half-baked theories, we should talk to some experts. And I asked my good friend, Sarah Mesley, to come and talk to us. Sarah, if you could introduce yourself, who are you and what do you do?
My name is Sarah Mesley. I'm a professor at USC, and I am a writer and editor, and I write a lot about the long history of the American popular novel. And I'm particularly interested in how the recent trend in YA literature has connected to energies of novels past.
So you're basically exactly who we should be talking to right now.
I'm a master. No other word.
So if you're looking at the history of the popular novel, and I know that you know a lot about youth literature, is what we see as a recent development of dystopian worlds in this fictional world, is that a new thing, or is that something that you've seen sort of have a longer history?
I don't think dystopian fiction is a new thing. I do think that what's changed is that in the last 30 years, maybe, there's been this new kind of cultural attention to this young adult literary marketplace particularly, and something happened in particular within it, I would say maybe around 2010, that became really preoccupied with dystopias. So it's not that dystopia is new, and it's not exactly that literature for young adults are as new, but those two things lined up in a particular way within, I would say, about the last 10 years. So you are correct. That is new, as far as I can tell.
And we were thinking about, first of all, I'm glad that our theory is correct. But second of all, we're thinking about the ways in which, like, do you think this has prepared young people in any way for our current political moment?
I mean, like, the quick answer would be sure. Yeah. It's interesting because I think some of the dystopian YA fiction that you and I would think about as being super important, The Hunger Games is the most powerful example, is actually a little old for some of the young people who are currently leading us into our new brave revolutionary future. So, I mean, I was thinking before we were getting ready of talking about, like, I would really be interested, you know, Emma Gonzalez, how old was she when Hunger Games came out? And does she even remember that? You know, I mean, I'm sure she does, but she was 8 and on the cusp of something at that moment when this trend was sort of happening. So, I mean, there's a lot of interesting temporalities with YA. And one thing I would say is that it's, I think it's important to remember is that the people who always read the most YA fiction were middle-aged women. Like always. I mean, just in terms of who is buying the books and who is talking about it. So I think that one thing that we might actually say, just to elaborate on your theory, is that YA dystopian fiction helped us mother this generation of activists.
Oh, that's an interesting take. I like that.
Wow. Now, what about, we were also talking a lot about like Harry Potter.
Yeah.
In terms of presenting a time of political despair,
yeah,
and that being somewhat instructive.
Yeah, well, I mean, I totally think that that's true, right? That, I mean, you see that in poster signs about, like, just yesterday I saw a meme going around comparing Betsy DeVos to Dolores Umbridge, the horrible bureaucratic school administrator in Harry Potter. So I think, like, one thing that Harry Potter did, it's not that Harry Potter is the only, like, epic quest against evil fantasy saga that there is. I mean, certainly there's many. It's not the first one in any way. But one is that it's interesting to think about how Harry Potter really set all those like struggles between the powers of good and the powers of darkness in school bureaucracy, which maybe is new.
Yes.
The other thing to say is that like one of the best things about Harry Potter ever, I think, not only is it a good story, but just how brilliant and kind of sharp and attractive J.K. Rowling is with her use of language. So she gave us this great tools. Like, it feels good to call Betsy DeVos a Dolores Umbridge. It feels good to think about Trump as being Voldemort, although he's not quite that. You know, so she gave us this category of names that are really powerful and resonant and feel archetypal. And having words like that, I think, helps identify and communicate and talk about what's going on right now.
Hmm. So would you say that it might give younger people and older people a framework for sort of understanding the current moment?
Yes. I mean, totally, totally so. I mean, this isn't the only time that's happened. There's also a lot of like dystopian fiction, by which I mean particularly fiction that's set in this kind of future where there's this kind of culturally pervasive mind control. Like there was a lot of that, like Christopher Pike in the 60s and 70s. I definitely remember finding those books when I was a kid, and I did not lead to some dramatic uprising. sadly, in the way that the kids are now, right? So it's not that it's new that there's this stuff. I mean, I don't know. One thing that's interesting is that there's always been like literature and science fiction, and then there's been kids' literature, but really trying to make this book that's particularly YA, that's about the transition to adulthood and about like the first kind of like pulsing throbs of your adultness. That is something that has new space in like the publishing marketplace. And one thing that I think that dystopian YA books do that's really smart and interesting is that they line up. I mean, dystopias always have the sense of like there was the world and there was some point a fall into this darker dystopic order, right? And in YA books, those line up in an interesting way with the kind of character's experience of puberty.
Oh, so the fall of the culture's innocence is also the fall of the innocence of the protagonist.
Yes, almost always. And especially in dystopic books that are the big thing beyond Hunger Games, the most radical like swell of books, and this was this really noticeable thing that happened about 7 or 8 years ago, was this rise of reproductive dystopias, particularly so like The Handmaid's Tale, but particularly for young adults. And those had a really similar shape that happened over and over again, which is that the protagonist, and they're always told in the first person because that's the convention of the genre right now, is like a girl, and she like is super into her world, and then as she like starts to approach mating age, however that's defined, she all of a sudden realizes what's going on here is not right.
Huh.
And so it's like, oh, I was so excited to marry the handsome boy that was picked out for me. And now I've sort of realized that maybe I don't want to do that. Or what happens to those babies people are having? Or maybe I don't, what happens when you get to like go to the special school for grown-up girls that I'm so excited to go to? I think something bad might happen there. So it's like the girl the protagonist always realizes there's something wrong with the world as she comes to sexual awakening herself.
That's very painful. That's very painful. That's like, I'm about to go to college and get date raped. I don't think I want to do that.
Oh my gosh, I didn't even think about it that way, but that's totally true, right? Which, I mean, the other thing to say is that this is why, because so many of these stories are about the technologies of reproduction and how the state, however that's written, can co-opt those. One of the things that it allows girls to think through is the way that some of the things that you can't escape aren't systemic governmentally, they're systemic biologically, right? Like, what does it mean to enter into the world of your own reproductive future, which is going to tell a story for you that you're not in charge of, right?
And then how are you going to manage that? How are you going to resist against that? I think it's also really interesting. I was talking to my niece yesterday, and she's reading at school. They were like looking at dystopias, and they were reading 1984, and they were reading Brave New World. And she's kind of over the genre of dystopian YA fiction, although a lot of her friends are still very much in it, to the point where she says that like they're carrying that in their imaginations as they go about the world, like all the time. But what she was saying that I thought was interesting was that she found those books more compelling. And I remember how when I grew up, books like 1984 and Brave New World were very much high school teaching tools. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That was always a very like instructive book. Like that's what you were going to read in high school English. And it's interesting, but they don't have this sort of overwhelming arc of successful resistance.
No, really,
like it doesn't work out that way. And I feel like these YA books
Yes, they totally do. They are almost always tales of triumph. Although I guess I would say that that's one thing I like about The Hunger Games is that, and that's, you know, like the most like resonant one is that I always feel like the ending of those books is very much a compromise. Like you can get through, but it will cost you something, which I think is a good thing for kids to read. I feel like we both have stories of triumph and stories of like, okay, but life looks like not what you wanted most of the time, but that doesn't mean it's not worth living. I think that's especially important for girls to like anticipate the sense of your own, I don't know, compromise. That sounds like so complicitous somehow when I'm saying it this way, but I guess I just feel like we need to have better role models of how hard it is.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, it's the difference, I think, between novels that serve as a fantasy and a playing out of a fantasy versus a novel that actually might prepare a young person for the real challenges of life, even if it's through a fantastical setting or, you know, futuristic setting.
Yeah, totally. The one thing I wanted to say too, this is a little bit of a tangent, but that when you asked me to be on this to talk about the importance of dystopias to revolution and YA dystopias to this kind of revolutionary energy, and then it comes to mind, like Hunger Games, all of this other series. But there's a way that I always kind of want to stand up for Twilight, which has such a bad rap. You know, the opposite of feminist in all these ways. But I think that's a narrow idea of feminist, number one. And number two, those are such great books that put the emotion, where this girl is insistent that her emotional life and her desires are the most important thing. And like that completely energize around her like psychic desires. And I guess I want to stand up also for the, not just the dystopic YAs, but for the swell of books that take YA desire, take young adult desires and hopes and dreams as fundamentally important and world moving. Even if they don't look revolutionary in the way that we think, as themselves telling girls that they matter and that their experiences of girlhood matter and have power in the world.
So would you say, in your estimation and your familiarity with YA literature over time, that that theme is more prevalent now or has recently been more prevalent than in the past?
That's a good question. I mean, I guess I would say I think these things ebb and flow. So, I mean, if you look back at novels from the 1840s, some of the first American bestsellers, I wouldn't necessarily think of most of those as revolutionary in the way that we are talking about right now. And then I also wouldn't think about them as being exactly young adult, but I think they're sort of the root of the like romantic wilderness roman. But also, I mean, like, you know, like the iconic thing to say would be like, oh, Uncle Tom's Cabin, right? Which starts off with a young boy growing to manhood. That's not the most famous story within it, but that is the through line of the book. And that famously is like, oh, here's, you know, here's the book that started the Civil War. And that's super simple and that's not true. But novels like that have been tied to this kind of emotional energy of this is not okay for a long time. Mm-hmm. One thing, though, that I think is important, too, right now with YA is that it's not just that there are these books, but there are what is totally new now. Is the incredible communities for talking about these books with writers and other readers across space because of social media, not only Twitter, but also Tumblr and Instagram. And although YA internet communities, and I guess I want to be careful here, can be wound, and I will say that because I have antagonized them without meaning to. But that said, they are incredibly politicized. And the drive in YA to be like, we need diverse books, we need diverse characters, we need diverse writers. Like that community is a very politicized community. So it's not just the books themselves, it's the way that. And this is partly like driven by publishing houses, sure, but it's also very much driven by these intense fan communities. And I think it's really good to think about young girls who like books, learning how to talk to each other about those books and then translating that energy, not just girls, but I always kind of want to give props to the girls because like that fan energy has often like sort of been like, oh, fan girls, they're so stupid and squealing and like Team Jacob, whatever. Yeah, but like, learning how to talk to each other that ways in those ways about what you want, even though they do tend to have like a disciplinary function about like, okay, do I want the right thing? Are you wanting the right thing? Is what, you know? But that is a good way to learn how to make things happen.
Well, that kind of gets to one of my theories about Harry Potter, which even though it came out, you know, started almost 20 years ago, I think has become such a huge cultural touchstone and kind of eclipses a lot of other youth literature. I think that what I notice is that the fandom, particularly online, but it's very like participatory. There's a level of engagement around the Harry Potter world and the Harry Potter characters that goes beyond I read this book, you read this book, let's talk about it. What did you like about it? And goes into this, what Hogwarts house are you in? What's your Patronus?
Right. I was talking to one of my students today about it. I was interviewing her and she said that when she was in high school, she knit her and her best friend Slytherin scarves. And I was like, you're in Slytherin? And she's like, well, yeah, because we were emo. And I was like, that's awesome. Like, it was so good.
I feel like there's something to that in connecting it to student and teen activism, that they are not recipients of these stories. They're not necessary. And the lessons aren't explicit in the stories. Like when we would read 1984 or, you know, To Kill a Mockingbird or these other books that we were assigned in school that were supposed to awaken us socially in an explicit way, you sort of understand what the message of the book is. But I feel like Harry Potter is operating on a different level where it's creating this world that readers want to be a part of, they continue to want to be a part of, and then just naturally embedded into that world are a lot of ideas about government and bureaucracy and school bureaucracy and where good and evil can live in your life.
And not only are students and readers embedding themselves in that world, but they're generating more of that world. Some of the most popular subsequent YA authors like Cassandra Clare started off as writing fan fiction. Another really amazing writer, Rainbow Rowell, who I would recommend to anybody, wrote a book called Fangirl that's about a girl who writes fan fiction. And then Rainbow Rowell wrote the novel that the character in Fangirl herself is writing, which is like a remake of Harry Potter where Harry and Draco are in this incredibly fraught gay romance for years. So like there's all these ways that the stories have created more stories. And now I'm sure there's fan fiction about the, you know, like the imaginary fan fiction that's the fan fiction, you know, so it's like layers and layers of world making. And I think that, I mean, like here we're kind of like at the intersection of dystopia and fantasy genres, but both of those are really heavily dependent on the pleasure of them, and the success of them depends on the author's abilities to make believable worlds. And to engage with those novels and to love them and to extend them, it requires readers to do the same things themselves.
Hmm.
And that itself is political.
All right.
So you're right.
Good. I love hearing that.
That's basically the point of all of this. We are correct.
We're right. We just wanted some confirmation.
That's all. Yeah. That's all.
I do think that's interesting. And I guess what I would say is that I do think it's really important to think about this not only as kids, but like, I mean, I say this as, you know, middle-aged lady with my kid in middle school, right? That I do think that my kid just read The Hunger Games, but I read The Hunger Games, and the reason he read them is because I had them in the house, because I read them. You know, right. But I do think that it's like these levels of fiction that are available to all of us that kind of like help set us up for kids to be this thing. And I guess I think like that's really cool, right? Like all these dystopias, that these reproductive dystopias I was talking about, those were really read by a lot of middle-aged women dealing with infertility and IVF and just like all the levels of the ways that this world gets in our bodies, and that we need to think about imagining new ways to deal with that. I think that's something really important for kids, but it's also a way that we can connect with kids.
Mm.
And I think that that's good. We being me, I guess, or us as ladies of a certain age, I think like that's important to remember how we can kind of tap into and support that ourselves.
Oh, that's so awesome. Thank you so much, Sarah.
Okay, bye, dears. Take care. Thank you.
All right, Rebecca, drunk-o-meter.
Here's where we rate how drunk we are on a scale of 1 to 10.
Yes.
With one sentence.
Yes. With one sentence.
With one sentence of elaboration.
Yes.
I would say I am at a 5.
Well, that's very good.
And I am intrigued by this soju, and I'm curious to learn more.
I'm at a 4. And I'm just really hoping I don't fall asleep while watching Black Panther tonight.
Oh, you're going to see Black Panther.
Yes, I am.
Oh, you're not going to fall asleep. You won't fall asleep. But you might want to have a few more drinks before the movie. Just to keep it rolling, you know? Maybe do you have a flask you could bring? Just like slip it in your purse?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. I think I do have a flask. You know, the one flask I ever had was a half flask, half cigarette case.
Oh my god.
And I don't smoke anymore, so it's like I don't even know where it is. Write us saucepodcast@gmail.com. find us at saucepodcast on Twitter. Rate us on iTunes. Tell us stuff you want us to ruin, because we will do that for you. Come on, guys. You can always find me at Maya Garantz on Twitter, or MayaGarantz@gmail.com.
And I am Gynostar on Twitter and Instagram and anywhere else.
So I want to say thank you to my niece, Charlotte Lamb, to Essie Reeves, my student, to Sarah Mesley for their incredible insights. And then also your niece.
Yes, my niece, Marcy Peck.
Thank you, guys.
Yes, thank you all for your time and your very intelligent and thoughtful answers.